is soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sandy stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned babies.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who
news goo. Hi there, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with another interview for MediaChannel.org, talking with people in the media, journalists and executives, consumers, and people who are commentators about our media system, what's good about it, what's wrong with it, what can be done to fix it. And the person on with us this week is someone I have a great deal of respect for, Dar Jamal. Dar was born in 1968, the year that I was, you know, running roughshod over the American counterculture. He's an American journalist, was one of the few unembedded journalists to report extensively from Iraq during the 2003 Iraq invasion. He spent 8 months in Iraq between 2003 and 2005. His stories appeared on something called Dar Jamal's Mideast Dispatches. He was a reporter from Truthout. His material was really respected across the media spectrum of people who were concerned about the crimes of the Iraq War. So welcome, Dar Jamal, joining us here, and thank you for being on with us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Danny. Good to be talking with you.
Well, one of the things about you, Dar, is A, you're a Lebanese-American, and you grew up in Texas. So that is something that makes you a foreigner in New York terms. You graduated from A&M University, but then you moved to Alaska, which couldn't be further away. At the same time, you I think, unilaterally decided to go to Iraq and to report there. You didn't go as part of a big network news operation. You went as part of a individual effort with a translator. And tell us about that. How was it that you decided to report on Iraq? How did you get into journalism?
Well, it was basically the outrage that I felt that was shared by millions of Americans during the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, of looking at the media, knowing the facts that there were no WMDs, that all the reasons being given by the Bush administration for the invasion were falsehoods, lies, and just becoming completely outraged by what I was watching. And then watching the invasion take place despite the massive international protests and of course, not having UN Security Council ratification. I mean, just watching egregious violation of international law, watching the government of my country commit the mother of all war crimes, which is a war of aggression, and then all the while watching the so-called mainstream media's laughable coverage of it, from Judith Miller and Michael Gordon's co-authored bogus pieces for the New York Times, quoting the infamous Bush administration, anonymous Bush administration officials talking about their WMDs. And we all know that. This is an old story.
Well, what is it that you saw? I assume you watch television like many Americans. They have a lot of television sets in Texas. What was it that you saw about the coverage that really gave you the feeling that this was, you know, an exercise in deception?
Well, it was exactly the fact that Judith Miller's stories of watching this, you know, them being spoon-fed the information from Dick Cheney and other people within the Bush administration, and then them printing the stories, and then Cheney and all of his ilk going on the big talk shows on mainstream television, and then citing the New York Times of covering what they're saying. I mean, it was the most set up, orchestrated, really fundamental evidence of propaganda I think we've seen in modern times. That, coupled with just the graphics, the kind of the salivation for war of all the networks, you know, Saddam Hussein's face with a target on it, as though he was the only person in the entire country. The complete ignoring of the ramifications of this on the Iraqi people, let alone the U.S. troops that would be involved. I mean, really, the total dehumanization of the effort, the hyping it up, the, you know, using graphics and slick models of warplanes and warships and tanks, turning war, you know, really the bottom of the human existence, you know, the depths that we can possibly sink to as a species, turning it into a glorified video game, and it repulsed me.
Well, you weren't alone, obviously. I did a film about it and wrote two books about it and was equally upset, as were so many people in our media in this country. But you did something that many people didn't do who were against the war here. You decided to go to Iraq and to really report from there. What made you do that, and what was that like? I mean, it was an act of either bravery or stupidity at the time. I'm sure there were people who told you, don't do it, it's dangerous and the like, but you did. Why did you do it, and what did you find when you got there?
Well, it's probably a combination of bravery and stupidity. I also refer to it as an act of desperation, because I felt like I was going crazy, you know. I mean, as I know so many people in this country were, of seeing what was going on, knowing the facts, and yet watching the government do what they were going to do anyway, and at great, great cost abroad, and for the Iraqi people particularly. And I just decided, well, they're doing this and getting away with it because they're controlling the information, they're controlling the media. So one thing I could do was I could go over there and write about what I saw, write about what how this was affecting the Iraqi people, and try to provide some of the information that I, and I know other people, were so desperate to hear, which was uncensored, real writing about, and photography about, how this was directly impacting the Iraqi people. And I was in a situation where I was, you know, by myself. I had a couple thousand dollars in savings and wanted to go do something that might make a difference. And so I figured out how to get into Baghdad by contacting a Lebanese guy who was blogging in there about what was going on. And he basically said, go to this hotel in Jordan. You can stay there, get a ride into Iraq, come to this hotel in Baghdad, and you'll meet some other independent folks there and be on your way. And so once I basically did just that, I just bought a plane ticket, packed the bag, headed on over. And once I got in there on the ground, things just, there was a lot of serendipity involved. I was able to find an Iraqi who was willing to work with me for not very much money, because I didn't have much, as my interpreter. And we started just going out on the streets and into the hospitals and in people's homes and interviewing people. And I was able to start writing literally the day I set foot in Baghdad.
Well, you know, a lot of the American media there was actually formerly part of the military mission. They were embedded. They were controlled. They were managed by the American military and its various operatives. But you were unembedded, and you had to basically develop some sense of trust from a population that must have been horrified by what was happening to their country, the bombing and the abuse that they were being subjected to.
Well, it was easy to earn the trust, because the Iraqi people are very politically astute, as you would have to be living under dictatorship for decades. You have to be smart and be able to think on your feet and be politically astute about how things work in the real world. So they understood the whole embedded reporting thing. They had access, once the invasion happened and all the satellite images started popping up on people's TVs, they had access to international media, and they could see the types of reporting being done by the mainstream reporters who were embedded. And so when me and a handful of other independent journalists were able to go around not wearing flak jackets and helmets, not riding around in Humvees with the troops, but going right out into the streets and right into people's homes and talking with them point blank, then I was welcomed warmly. In fact, people were very happy to talk to me, and there was so much information coming in because of that, it was difficult for me to keep up with the stories.
How would you characterize the gap or the difference between what you were covering and what other journalists were covering?
Well, compared to most of the mainstream coverage, it was night and day. I mean, I in my first book, Beyond the Green Zone, I highlighted one example after another of a big event that unraveled on the ground, like when I was there when Saddam Hussein was captured in December, I think, I believe it was December 13, 2003. And, you know, the fact that it was being, you know, we knew in Baghdad that it was the Kurds who found him, and the Kurds had actually led the Americans to him. And this was broken on the ground in Baghdad several hours before it hit the mainstream press in the U.S. Some of that was also because of the timing of it, because it happened just before noon, if I remember correctly. And then how that was reported and spun in the mainstream as though it was all the U.S. military. They found him. They were, the, you know, mission accomplished kind of stuff. Totally bogus. You know, that wasn't the case. It was, you know, if it weren't for the Kurds, that they wouldn't have been ever been able to find him probably. And then, you know, just one example of another of, you know, what I was seeing on the ground, literally the first week I was there, I was hearing about torture in U.S. military detention facilities and in Abu Ghraib, and started writing about this in my blog. And then, you know, it was quite a bit of time later. It was almost a year later after that that the torture stories started to come out.
It took a year, essentially, for the first reports that you and others compiled and for the story to be vindicated, if you will, legitimated by the major media. This is like Edward Snowden being interviewed by NBC fully a year, almost a year after he first went public with his findings.
Right, right. And that's amazing. And Danny, I know, I mean, you're a veteran. You've been seeing this firsthand for decades and decades. There's this huge time lag between real events on the ground and what actually happens. And of course, how the massive amount of misinformation by the mainstream media when those things are happening. And then when the reality actually comes out, I mean, another example would be, and this still has really yet to be reported much in the mainstream in the U.S. It was a story broke by the BBC and The Guardian, quote unquote, broke by them a couple of years ago about retired Colonel James Steele operating in Baghdad, setting up the death squads alongside John Negroponte back in 2004.
Let's go through this a little slower, because James Steele was an American colonel in Iraq, but he was also formerly an aide to John Negroponte, who was an American ambassador to El Salvador, a country that was associated with death squads and American support for all kinds of abuse. Then then Negroponte gets sent to Baghdad as the U.S. ambassador. And he takes with him or brings along James Steele, who begins to do the same thing in Baghdad that he had been doing in El Salvador. Correct? Do I have that right?
No, that is precisely right. And that is why in 2006, then Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld referred to using the quote unquote Salvador option in Iraq, because it was already underway. It was basically a regurgitation of the policy used under Reagan in Central America that led to tens of thousands of deaths and horrible atrocities and mutilations. And the exact same thing was replicated in Baghdad. And I would argue, and I think confidently so, that what we're seeing today in Baghdad with the rampant sectarianism is in large part due to exactly that policy.
So I want to take you there, because in the American media, you know, frame, this is a conflict in Iraq today between the Shia and the Sunni, tribal, you know, differences, ethnic conflict. These people just can't get along with each other. They're killing each other and the like. And it's not, you know, anything that the United States was responsible for in any way. It was there before we got there. It'll be there after we leave. You know, that's the problems. The Israelis then spin this as saying, well, it's a fundamental problem of Islamic, you know, culture, barbarism, and the like. And these ideas are reinforced in the media narrative and the media frame. A lot of people who watch the media don't always realize that there's a narrative here, that these stories tend to be very much like each other and have certain assumptions and select information in similar ways and reinforce similar points. So here we have this Shia-Sunni divide, which is really the way we're being told to examine this. Now, interestingly enough, in my blog, my own blog at newsdissector.net, I make reference to stories in the Fars news agency in Tehran and the El Manar news agency out of out of, I guess, Hezbollah in Lebanon. And both of them are rejecting. I mean, they're against this ISIS movement, but they're also rejecting this notion that all of this can be blamed on ethnic hatred. What was your experience with that in Iraq?
Well, that's accurate. I mean, the sectarianism thing in Iraq came up virtually right after Baghdad fell. I mean, and it's one of my first experiences with it. I interviewed a religious sheikh in Bakuba, just outside of Baghdad. And he told me, look, Baghdad fell on April 9. He said less than a week later, we had a military commander come to Bakuba and call all of the religious and tribal leaders together, him being one of them, as a religious sheikh, and said they've called them all into a big tent that they had set up for the occasion and said, okay, all the Shia on one side, all the Sunni on the other. And he said, we just all looked at each other and said, oh, okay, they're going to do exactly what the Brits did back in the 1920s, classic neo-colonial divide and conquer tactics. And from that, and then we move on to how they set up the Iraqi Governing Council, the IGC, set up specifically along sectarian, religious, and ethnic lines. I mean, strictly, that was the representation. It was designed to fail. It was designed for divide and conquer. And then going on into...
This is important, Dar, only because, you know, people on the left or activists tend to see things in ideological terms. They think to see, you know, the neocon philosophy and all that. They don't really necessarily understand how this is done. And then there's almost a neocolonial anthropology behind it, a theory. And this came out, of course, in some of the torture of Iraqi men, you know, which were, you know, saying that they can be humiliated because they're ashamed of their sexuality. And therefore, what we have to do is focus on that. In other words, there seems to be an anthropological, psychological strategy as well as a political one. True?
Well, that's precisely accurate, Danny. I've actually written about that at length. There's so-called human mapping being done where the U.S. military, specifically the CIA, is hiring more anthropologists. I think it's neck and neck between the CIA and Microsoft right now today as far as which of them are hiring the most anthropologists. Microsoft, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, I think this is important. I don't want to interrupt you, but I think it's important. You know, I've been doing some work on the Edward Snowden surveillance issues, and most people see it just as like my email and my phone calls are at risk, when actually it's a much more elaborate notion of surveillance and categorizing people on various categories so they can be better manipulated. So we see this in a situation of war where the conflict was, you know, really mapped out, if you will, by these so-called experts who actually created a way to manipulate people and divide them.
Well, that's precisely it. So the military basically, in short, brings in a whole bunch of trained anthropologists who already have are specializing on the region, on Shia or Sunni or various ethnicities in Iraq, to find out how better way to do the so-called win the hearts and minds, which basically means how can we better manipulate these people to our own agenda so that they'll do what we want them to do and not do what we don't want them to do. And that's exactly what they did. And then I think you using torture as an example is a great way to frame it, because when you see those pictures from Abu Ghraib where it is female soldiers doing the denigration to the men, stripping them down, making them naked, pissing and shitting on the Quran, this is all specifically designed. This isn't just random behavior. This is specifically designed as the best way to humiliate and break down and terrorize the local population.
So terrorism has this human dimension as well as a political dimension. Again, not fully understood, I think, you know, that there's a way of trying to terrorize people as individuals, as parts of a culture, and destroy that culture, a culture of solidarity, a culture of, historic links between peoples, and break those links down, you know, in the COINTELPRO programs in the United United States, the FBI, you know, created documents to try to reinforce racial animosity between people and sexual animosity as well.
That's right. And they did so very effectively. And when you have sectarian death squads, Shia sectarian death squads going out targeting Sunnis directly, and then the retribution battles began, and then that coupled with favoritism of one group over the other in the government, i.e. what's happening now, putting the Shia in power, keeping Maliki there, despite the fact that he didn't even win the original election that brought him into office. Alawi actually won more votes in that election, of course conveniently overlooking the fact that Alawi is a CIA asset. But keeping him in power, all these things taken together, you have a country that is completely disintegrated. This is how the U.S. has played a very proactive role in shredding the social fabric of the country. And that's exactly what I heard from Iraqis over and over and over, that U.S. policies in their country at the very beginning and then continuing all the way through the occupation was designed and did so very effectively shred the fabric of the society.
You know, it also shreds a kind of rationality. You know, Iraq had the most advanced university system in the whole Middle East. It was the highest educated population in many ways, the most, despite, you know, the contradictions of Saddam Hussein and his despotism. It was an economically advanced state relative to many of the other Arab states. Now, when you introduce into a culture that has its own rationality to it, how it's organized, and you begin to do things that are deliberately and consciously irrational to keep people guessing. This is what the Nazis used to do. They would go into a Jewish area, and they would give people a red piece of paper and a blue piece of paper. Okay? And people were now thinking, like, what's the better piece of paper to have? Am I likely to live longer with a red one than a blue one? So people start trading with each other because they've heard something or a rumor of some kind. And it turns out, of course, they kill everybody, okay, regardless of the color of piece of papers. But it's a way to throw people's moral and psychological assessment ability off kilter.
That's right, and it's very effective. And I mean, that is precisely what these policies did with the Iraqi people. It's keep them fighting amongst themselves, keep them involved in their own internal political squabbles. Who's going to control this ministry? Who's going to control that ministry? Who's going to get what percentage of the oil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, the U.S. is doing whatever it's going to do, and the main thing. At least with the goal of the death squads at that point from 05, 06, 07 was to turn Iraqi resistance guns away from the U.S. military and turn them towards other Iraqis. And that's what happened.
Now, you were in Fallujah. Of course, now Fallujah was called the mosque city. It was a city that had always been sort of independent, even of Saddam. It had its own, you know, kind of sense of itself. And it was not a Ba'athist stronghold, so to speak, until, the people in the community there were being terrorized by American soldiers. You wrote about this. And then Fallujah became really a target of a massive counterinsurgency campaign that just slaughtered people, just because they were there, it seems like, not because they had done anything. What was it like to observe this?
Well, it was horrifying. I had been in Fallujah during my first trip in Iraq. I was there back in December 2003 a couple of times, and then went in April 2004 on the 8th, just 5 days after the first siege started, and literally was in a makeshift clinic watching mostly women and children being brought in who had been shot by U.S. military snipers. I had a couple of friends, a couple of Westerners, as well as a couple of Iraqi colleagues, actually go out in an ambulance to try to film what was going on, as well as to be with them and watch them as they were trying to collect wounded people or dead bodies. And they were shot at. They literally had to hit the deck in the back of the ambulance that then came racing back with a couple of shot tires back to the clinic. And I saw and took pictures of the bullet holes going into one side of the ambulance and out the other, and the grouping of bullet holes right on the driver's side of the windshield that he had dove away from.
But then, But then as you began to write about this, there was a counter-narrative being offered. This was a hotbed of terrorists. This was a place where Al-Qaeda was based. This was a place that was totally anti-American. I don't think that was true.
No, I mean, and that I wrote about that extensively, both in my articles and my book, because it was, you know, again, it was a case of demonize the other, demonize the enemy. It was the U.S. who was the terrorist in this case, because it was essentially a situation where Fallujah was being Fallujah. It's a strong, proud city. Saddam never really had total control over it, even during his reign. He basically cut deals to keep it pacified and paid off a whole lot of money to make that so. And the U.S. tried to go in and subjugate it the same way Britain did in the 1920s. Britain used chemical weapons. The U.S. used white phosphorus and cluster bombs and depleted uranium and tried to take control of a city where the people simply didn't want to be occupied. And it was the U.S. who set the whole chain of events off there in the first place, because when the original invasion happened, there wasn't even any fighting in Fallujah. The people of Fallujah said, look, okay, you're going to come on in. We didn't really like Saddam either. We're not happy that you're here, but we're not going to fight you. But then shortly thereafter, when U.S. military personnel occupied a secondary school for boys, people held demonstrations for it. The U.S. started shooting unarmed demonstrators, and thus the resistance.
Let's remember what those demonstrations were. These were parents saying, let the kids go back to school. In other words, this was not about some grand ideological point. They were saying, this is our school. This is where our kids go to school. Let them go back to school. And what they got in response to those protests over an issue like that was bullets.
That's right. That's right. And so from that point on, the resistance began in Fallujah, and it increased to the point where by March of 2003, the U.S. military had stopped running patrols into the city because they couldn't do so without being hit within half an hour of entering the city. And then that set the stage for what happened to the Blackwater guys on March 31st. And then that set the stage for the brutal attack on the city. But quickly it became apparent to the U.S. military, and particularly the Bush administration at the time, they weren't going to be able to take the city. There was way too much effective resistance. They weren't going to be able to take the city unless they made a full-scale siege, and it was going to entail thousands and thousands of deaths. And so they had to pull out and wait and buy the time until after the upcoming November election, and then go back in November and kill between 4,000 and 6,000 people to get the job done.
Now, why weren't your colleagues there, other reporters? They must have seen some of this. They must have asked some questions and tried to get some background. How is it that they're reporting on a case like this, which was a sort of open and shut case of a community being terrorized and destroyed? How is it that that story never really got out?
Well, because all of the mainstream reporters that I know of were embedded with the military. And when you embed with the military, they're going to control where you go, what you see, and in a lot of instances, even exactly how you're going to report it. So they literally chose not to put themselves in a position where they could report on the Iraqi side. All they could do is be with the military, go around, report what the military was telling them, report what they were seeing with the military, that basically, hey, all these guys are with Al-Qaeda, all of them are with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, all of this kind of nonsense, not fact-based at all propaganda that the U.S. military was spinning at the time. And so that's why most of the coverage simply reflected that.
Well, as you know, because we were at a conference together in Italy about this, is that while there were war crimes that were committed, there were also media crimes committed in Iraq. And I want to return to that and talk about what's happening with ISIS now in Iraq. When we come back in a few minutes, please stay with us. Dar Jamal, a brilliant Iraq reporter who also, and I don't want to not get into this, is now reporting on the climate crisis brilliantly as he did about Iraq. So stay with us now for more coming up on Media Channel Radio.
Come all you good workers and all you dispossessed. Prison, nobody has confessed. I said, which side are you on, boy?
fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. That's Media Wars here on Media Channel Radio with Dar Jamal. Dar, right now the crisis in Iraq is back on. The media is going there or trying to report on it. What's your take on all this? You spotted some of these ISIS guys and referenced them years ago. Who are they, and how does this new phase of the war factor and figure?
Well, context, as you know, Danny, is everything about stories. And I want to bring people back to the very end of 2012 when Sunni protests started happening across much of the country, particularly Al-Anbar province, against Maliki and his government, because the Sunnis were tired of being disenfranchised, tired of being kept out of the political process, tired of Iraqi military forces, coming into their neighborhoods, doing home raids, detaining people, kidnapping people, killing people, including women. And so they started these protests every Friday, and then it grew to a point where all through 2013, outside of Fallujah and other parts of Anbar, the protests would, they started closing down the highway that linked Amman, Jordan, and Baghdad, and having Friday prayers and then demonstrations out there on the highway. Well, after a while, the Maliki forces started coming in and killing unarmed protesters. And I was there in March a year ago. It was March 2013, and I went to one of these protests. And I was on the stage with some of the tribal leaders and religious leaders of the area. This is in Fallujah, on the highway, right on the outskirts of Fallujah. And they were telling this very, very angry crowd of tens of thousands of demonstrators, said, look, just wait. We're trying to use politics in Baghdad to fix this. We don't want this to escalate. And we literally had to evacuate the stage because the crowd, mostly young men, was so angry that they started pelting us with water bottles, shoes, and rocks. And so myself, other journalists, Iraqis I was with, and then even all the tribal and religious leaders of the area had to literally vacate the stage. And a lot of the people in the crowd were waving the black ISIS flags. And so that was back in March 2013. So people already wanted to fight. The leaders were barely keeping a cap on the situation. So when this thing exploded and ISIS made this lightning takeover of Mosul and then several other cities, you know, it was clear that this wasn't just ISIS. This was them tapping into a deep resentment across much of the Sunni community against the Maliki regime and these young guys who'd been completely disenfranchised. They suffered horribly through the sanctions, horribly through the U.S. occupation. And then now they've got a chance to take it to the man. They've got a chance to take the fight to Maliki and Baghdad and anybody affiliated with them. And that's why ISIS has enjoyed so much broad support. And that's what we're seeing today. So it is ISIS. They are radicals, but it's not them acting alone. They are now acting in concert in a lot of places with former Baathist military, seasoned military leaders who know what they're doing. That's why they're taking ground and holding it. That's why they're being very effective and very strategic about what they're doing and have broad popular support in a lot of the areas.
There have been some reports suggesting that ISIS is a different type of animal, that it was part of Al-Qaeda or was affiliated, then it went on its own, and that it's a corporate structure, very conscious of raising money, reporting on its activities, almost run like a corporation very efficiently. And maybe that's part of its strategy to raise money from various patrons like the Qataris or the Saudis or the Kuwaitis.
Well, that's right. That's right. And they've been very, very effective in that way and strategic again. And the other, in addition to what you just said, another really important part of this story, and I know that you're aware of this, Danny, too, is that ISIS is not nearly as powerful or well-equipped or has as much money as it does if it's not for U.S., Qatar, Saudi policy in Syria, where they have been backing, funding, and arming ISIS there directly and indirectly against Assad. So we literally have an amazing catch-22 situation playing out in real time, where on the one hand, you have these U.S. groups in Syria who've come in as ISIS, now invading Iraq, starting the beginnings of setting up an Islamic State there. And they're now fighting directly against Maliki, who the U.S. has also sold now over $25 billion worth of arms and training and counting.
Well, you know, Maliki is blaming the United States because they didn't deliver the planes on time or something that they had bought. They said that they were being, you know, that they had been betrayed by the United States. And if they had had planes, they could have stopped the ISIS offensive. I'm not sure if that's really true, if they had the Air Force that could have done that. But that's what they're saying now. The Saudis and the Qataris are not saying much. And Obama is going to the Congress asking, you know, just today for $500 million to train more effective moderates in Syria, he's saying. So in other words, there's an escalation of this conflict. Meanwhile, Israel seems to be encouraging the splintering of Iraq, buying oil from the Kurds, and encouraging, you know, this sort of breakup, bombing Syria and the like. So it looks like this whole conflict is becoming regionalized in a major way, with Putin even saying he was going to support Maliki. And on top of that, the Iranians are reportedly sending arms to the border, sending drones based on American drone designs that they've captured into the country.
It is. And, you know, this is another thing, Danny, that I know yourself and many other analysts talked about at the beginning of this, even before the war was launched, that there was a chorus of people saying, look, this invasion and occupation will destabilize not just Iraq, but the entire region, and quite possibly eventually lead to a regional war that could even spread beyond that. And, okay, it's taken it, you know, there's been flashes where it's become regional. There have been some cross-border skirmishes on the Syrian border. There has obviously direct Iranian involvement in Iraq, thanks in large part to the U.S. facilitating it by propping up Maliki, who's head of the Dawah Party and spent 8 years of his life in Tehran. So there's been some, but nothing on the magnitude that we're looking at now, where literally you have Syrian airstrikes now happening on Iraqi soil. You have Israeli airstrikes happening in Syria, and you have U.S. now sending troops once again back in, the advisors, so-called advisors, back
in. Terrorists in Beirut. I mean, you know, it seems as if this whole situation is going to not get any better anytime soon, and in fact is getting worse. Meanwhile, I don't think our press is really keeping up with it and explaining any of the underlying dynamics, what the context is, what the background is, what ISIS is and what it says it does. I mean, it actually issues a very, you know, long and complex reports about their activities. They're not shy about doing it. They have a very effective social media campaign as well, bragging about the advances. And also there are reports in the media of people in towns like Mosul saying, look, we welcome them because we can't stand the Maliki Iraqi army. They're much more brutal.
That's right. And so, of course, we're not going to hear that in the mainstream media, because they'd effectively have to tell on themselves if they started reporting on this accurately, because they would have to talk about context and a lot of the stuff that we just discussed about U.S. unbridled support for Maliki, despite the crimes that he's committed against humanity in Iraq for all the years that he's been prime minister. They'd have to talk about the U.S. selling $25 billion worth of arms and more to him. They'd have to talk about U.S. complicity in all of this.
Let's make a point about this. When they sell the arms, okay, this is business. They're making money on selling these arms. And the money is coming out of Iraqi oil revenues, which now the ISIS has taken over, apparently, one of the main refineries there. So, you know, this is a situation where the economy is collapsing, trade is impossible, the borders are porous, Kuwaitis and rather the Iraqis, are being backed by the Qataris, who are also fighting with the Saudis. I mean, how do you make sense of it?
Well, it's confusing because the other part of this story is that there's no coherence in the Obama strategy in the Middle East, just like there was no coherence to the Bush strategy. This thing was doomed before it started. We all knew that. They went in. You know, anybody who stood up against Bush before the invasion, any military leader who said, look, you can't do it with this number of people. You can't do it the way you're talking about doing it. You can't get ready to have an occupation. He fired him. And this thing has been chaos and confusion from the beginning. Obama, of course, just took the reins of that policy and kept charging forward. And now that's why we have Iraq looking like it, the entire region looking like it is today, where you have the U.S., you know, look at what they're doing in Syria and how that's translated into this disaster in Iraq right now.
Is it that they just don't know better? I mean, I just read a report about how the CIA missed the whole story. You know, here they are spying on you and me and our emails. Okay, and what websites we visit. Apparently have figured out how to do that. But they don't seem to be able to understand what's going on the ground in Iraq. And they missed, the ISIS thing. In fact, the Telegraph in London says that the Kurds told them 5 weeks ago that ISIS was preparing this offensive, and they couldn't get them to respond.
I saw that. Yeah. And it's, you know, Danny, this is where I'm at this point regarding U.S. plans. You know, there's theories out there that this is by design, that the U.S. wants to fragment the region because they want the Iraq to be split up into three states. And I don't know. I haven't seen anything that I would call proof of that, but certainly this complete incoherence of what's happening and the fact that it does seem hard to believe that the CIA would miss something like this forming, particularly given their extremely heavy involvement in Syria. So, you know, there's a lot of parts of the story that I don't know. I mean, it's hard to believe that they wouldn't have seen
this. But it's not just that you don't know. Excuse me, Dar, you know so much more than most of us, okay? But it's not just that you don't know. It's like nobody's asking these questions. This is what is like the real failure of the media here. They're not really pressing on these points and trying to flesh this out. Some of them have contacts. Some of them have information, and yet, you know, somehow they're not pursuing it. Now, you know, in terms of your own experience, I don't know if you still are affiliated with Al Jazeera, but you were. What was that like for you? You living in Doha, in Qatar?
Yeah, I am not affiliated with them anymore. I worked for Al Jazeera English in Doha, Qatar from June 2011 until this past March. And it was a very interesting experience, very eye-opening. I joined them because I really respected the coverage that they had of the Iraq war. Of course, bearing in mind that this was Al Jazeera Arabic's coverage of that situation, and not English didn't even exist yet until 2006, let alone Al Jazeera America. But, you know, I had a lot of frustrations because as a journalist who's been independent his whole career up until that time, going in and basically being trapped in a building and having to kind of fight to get out to be allowed to do big stories that I had covered both in Iraq as well as the BP oil spill. I mean, I got sent out to do some reporting, but, you know, as is common, I think, in any big media organization, you're scraping and clawing to try to get your way out of the building to go do coverage. So that was rather frustrating. And there were a lot of things about it that it wasn't really that dissimilar from a lot of the major media in the U.S. I see so many people in the U.S., particularly on the left, that like to sing the praises of Al Jazeera. But I really wonder if those people have been watching Al Jazeera English or Al Jazeera America's coverage very closely, because if you look at their actual news coverage, it really doesn't differ that much from the BBC.
Yeah, the Economist magazine has a little piece about Qatar and about the new emir. The old emir stepped down. His son took over. And apparently one of the things he was proudest of or was pushed to do was to, quote, tone down Al Jazeera. This is quoted in The Economist. He toned it down. Well, it sort of toned me out because I had been writing for Al Jazeera for several years and suddenly, you know, was unable to get a single article published there. And so it was obviously there was some sort of policy connected, I think, in part to the role Qatar played in Libya, the role it probably played in Egypt, and its more proactive role in Syria. And so the media coverage tended to, not advance necessarily, but not contradict what the government was doing. It became, like our own media, more influenced by the people in power.
And then if you look at how Al Jazeera America has performed, and, you know, people, I'm sure most people are aware of the fact that Al Jazeera bought Current TV from Al Gore, so they already had an existing broadcast TV network structure in place, and they've dumped approximately $2 billion into it. They have over 800 of probably some of the highest paid journalists in the world working in over a dozen bureaus across the country. And Nielsen came out with the TV ratings, and, you know, Nielsen's kind of the standard on how we measure who's watching which TV channels. And around the 6-month anniversary of Al Jazeera America's launching, which was a little ways, a few months ago now, but they came out with a story that said, well, how's Al Jazeera America doing 6 months on? And when you consider the fact that, Fox was leading the pack in the U.S. with, I think, over 10, 12 million primetime viewers. CNN was right up there, right behind Fox. And then I think the majors like ABC, CBS, NBC had the high single-digit millions of primetime viewers. And Al Jazeera America was bringing up the rear with 15,000 primetime viewers. So they're not exactly doing real well.
So that's less than a small radio station in a major market. But you know, that aside, it seems to have been a political decision not to really challenge the American media, but to become more like the American media. Former executive at ABC, the network I worked for, became the head of Al Jazeera America. It seemed like they were trying to be pleasers more than really be competitors. And that, I think, is very demoralizing for people who join a news organization in order to do something that they believe in and really want to have a sense of mission, and they find themselves frustrated at every turn. And in many cases, I was as well, wrote about it. And the more you watch, the less you know. My own experience is there. So this is not a news story to me, but it is painful, I think, for people who really respected Al Jazeera's commitment and the fact that many of their journalists were killed and some are in prison now in Egypt. They've sacrificed a great deal. One was put in Guantanamo. I mean, these people struggled to get the truth out and are now facing not just a problem from, you know, other Arab governments, but their own government, you know, in restraining what they can do. And sometimes it's done in a very subtle way. You know, troublemakers are screened out or made to feel unwelcome and the like. And that's what happens. But one thing that did happen to you, and you wrote about this, and I can't let this interview go by without referencing this, is that, you know, you began to feel, you describe, you know, a sense of rage when after you left Iraq, a feeling of fury, if you will. You called yourself a human time bomb. What was that like, Dar?
Well, after coming out of a war zone, I mean, nobody comes out of a war zone unscathed, whether you're a soldier, a civilian, or a journalist. You're going to have some form of PTSD if you've been anywhere near where that kind of violence is ongoing and the dehumanization that comes with it. And after that point in time that I referenced in that recent article was after I had done 4 successive trips in Iraq, and I'd been shot at, I'd been near car bombs, I'd been walking through morgues that didn't have enough refrigeration for days on end. watching young children shot by U.S. soldiers die on operating tables. I mean, so I came back home extremely traumatized, and I basically was at a point going around giving talks back in the United States about what I'd seen in Iraq, and could basically feel nothing but rage or numbness. So it was kind of a classic PTSD, the same thing you'd hear from any soldier talking about what their experience was like coming back home too. And I had to take a break. I ultimately, over some time, had to take a break from going back in there for a while and do some personal work to kind of get my head back on straight. Because it's common in journalism for a lot of people to just keep the stiff upper lip, but you know, at some point that's going to come back to bite you one way or another.
You've done some stories about Iraqis who have been trying to, you know, bring war crimes actions under the Nuremberg principles against American officials. What's the status of that?
Well, there is an ongoing effort, which is very interesting, and actually part of it is within the United States. There's a law firm out in San Francisco, Inder Comer is the fellow's name, who's actually representing an Iraqi woman who lost her husband under the occupation, bringing charges, aiming to bring charges in the federal court against those responsible in the Bush administration for the entire invasion. So it's a trial that is actually has international implications, yeah. And it is in process. We're going to see where it goes next from here. But at the same time, there's a group called the Brussels Tribunal in Belgium who's been cataloging war crimes throughout the occupation from the beginning, and they actually are also exploring other international avenues in which to bring charges.
A lot of people don't remember that the, you know, Nuremberg trial was not about the Holocaust. It was about the crime of aggression, aggressive war. And this is the charges that are being made against the Bush administration, you know, planning a war of aggression, an illegal war of aggression. And that's, you know, what you've written about. And your material is up on your darjamal.com website, which is fascinating to read and download. Just one last thing. I know you've kind of reinvented yourself in some ways as a reporter dealing with the climate crisis. Tell me just briefly, we don't have much time left. What have you been discovering there, and why did you make this sort of transition? I think you probably did it from what you're telling me, you know, for your own mental health as well. But, you know, because the planet itself is at risk.
Oh, gosh, Danny. I mean, yeah, it is. It's the single biggest story of our time going forward now. I actually literally just earlier today conducted an interview with the former NASA chief scientist, Dr. Waleed Abdelati, who's now at University of Colorado Boulder as director of the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences. And he basically said, look, human being, I mean, one of the quotes of his that I'm going to write about, he says, we're effectively taking a sledgehammer to the climate system. And he said that when I was asking him to talk about in detail what human activity is having as impact on the global climate. And when we look around, I mean, I'm doing a monthly, I call it the Climate Disruption Dispatch for truthout.org. And we are regularly publishing that along with other climate related stories, because this is huge. It's happening now. It's upon us. We are locked in for very, very dramatic temperature increases going into the future, because clearly no government's taking the kind of dramatic action that would be necessary to really mitigate what's coming down the pike. But we're looking at, even according to the conservative international panel on climate change, the IPCC, their worst case predictions, which have consistently not kept up with actual events on the ground, but their worst case predictions now are looking at upwards of a 5 to 6 C temperature increase by 2100. And that's rather shocking, because the last time this planet saw 6 C over our pre-industrial temperature baseline, there were snakes the size of yellow school buses in the Amazon, and the largest living mammal was the size of a shrew.
Ooh. So we have a lot to look forward to on that front. But I think I'm glad that you're out there covering this, because I have so much respect for your, you know, reporting, your courage, not only as a reporter, but also the actual quality of the work that you do. And I'm so happy that you could join us here. This interview will be up on mediachannel.org. And, you know, please check it out. You can comment to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. As well, you can also keep listening to these interviews here on PRN. Thank you very much for being here. We'll be back next week with more. And please check out mediachannel.org for the interviews we've done about the media today and the problems that really confront us all in keeping informed about what's happening to our world. Thank you.
To chase and to walk home.